Welcome to the Essential Church Podcast. Our goal is to strengthen and equip church and ministry leaders just like you through practical and theological discussions about some of the most pressing and important issues facing the local church today. We feature conversations with members of our team here at New Life Church in Colorado Springs, Colorado, as well as interviews with authors and thinkers from around the world. You can follow the essential.church on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Watch episodes on our YouTube channel and also subscribe to our podcast via iTunes and Spotify, where you'll find a full archive of previous conversations. And now, here is this week's episode of the Essential Church Podcast.
Welcome to this episode of the Essential Church Podcast, an ongoing conversation about some of the most important issues facing the local church today. I'm your host, Andrew Arndt, and today I want to take you to a conversation that we had recently with our dear friend, Rich Velotis. Steve Cuss, if you listened to our podcast episode last week, Steve mentioned Rich. Rich has been a friend of ours for several years now. He's the lead pastor, teaching pastor of New Life Fellowship in Queens, New York, and we've actually interviewed him before. If you want to go back and listen, episode 12 of the Essential Church Podcast was a conversation with Rich on the blending of the charismatic and the contemplative traditions. That was a great conversation. Rich recently released a book called The Deeply Formed Life, Five Transformative Values to Root Us in the Way of Jesus, in which he looks out at society and sees some of the things that are plaguing us and dragging our humanity down, and proposes practices and ways of being that really restore our humanity and allow us to be the church in a fresh way. I think you're going to really enjoy the episode today, and without further comment from me, here's to the conversation. All right, well, we're with our dear friend Rich Velotis today. Rich, what's up, man?
Fellas, so good to be with you. You are three of my favorite people in the world, and being with you just a few months ago for dinner when I was out in Colorado Springs was a joy. So glad we can connect in this space.
Well, we just love you, man, and we love the work that you're doing. So for our listeners, viewers who are not aware of Rich, this is actually your second time on the podcast. So I was listening back to the first time we had you on. We had you on, this is episode 102, I think we've done, and we had you on episode 12. Wow. Way back when we were just getting started. Yeah, and that was it was a great conversation. We talked to you a little bit about your experience pastoring your church, New Life Fellowship there in Queens, New York, which you'll talk about more in the episode here. And it was a great conversation really on the blending of the charismatic and the contemplative traditions together. So we had so much fun talking with you. And I think that anybody that listened to that podcast, certainly us, we knew that a book like this that we're going to talk about with you today was coming from you, a book on spiritual formation. The title of the book here is The Deeply Formed Life, and we just think it's a marvelous book. So I think we knew that this book was coming. I'll tell you what was surprising to me about it when I read it is that I think I had an expectation going into it that you were going to lay out systematically some of your principles of spiritual formation and then make a turn to what you saw happening in the world. But as a matter of method, you actually did it the other way around. You diagnose five core issues that you see happening in our world and then talk about the way that the gospel speaks to that and the way that we embody a different way inside those things. So without getting into them yet, I'll let you talk about them as you will, but talk about why you started the way that you started, looking kind of out there and then making your way into practice.
For me, it flows out of the life of our community. And so it's a contextual incarnational work in that the five values flow out of the wrestling of formation and discipleship and theology out of many years in Queens, New York City. And so when I thought about this book, I thought, what is the work that we've been engaged in for many years? And because New Life is a very diverse community and an international community, much of this theology and formational practices have been worked out in this context, which for us transcends just our place in Queens. Mm-hmm. And so the simple answer is, this is the work that I've been doing as a pastor and thought, number one, our congregation needs this. And number two, because of our diversity, I think other Christians and churches and pastors could benefit from it. So it is on the ground theology, I think, which is why it was in some respect pretty easy for me to write because I was I've been wrestling with for many years.
Mm-hmm. So, Rich, why don't you name them for us, for our listeners and viewers today, the five areas, and you've grouped two chapters for each of the areas. So why don't you just describe that real quick?
Yeah, in terms of the flow, I wanted to give somewhat of a theological, biblical overview of the particular value that I write about, but I just didn't want to leave readers there. I wanted to help people individually and in the context of community begin to try to flesh it out in real time. And so whether we're talking about contemplative rhythms, whether we're talking about racial reconciliation, which is the second value, interior examination, sexual wholeness, and missional presence, those are the five values that actually at New Life in Queens, we call them our five M's. Mm. And so I wanted to, so it's basically, which for us, it's monastic, multiracial, emotional health, marriage. I know that doesn't start with an M, marriage to Christ, and missional. I wanted to provide language that was accessible to people outside of our context. But those are the five values that, number one, has shaped me individually for many, many years, for the 21 years that I've been following Christ. It has, those individual values have helped me. But for me, I saw it as a paradigm of a holding together of values that are often segmented. And so it is, in many respects, I think, it's a paradigm that I'm trying to offer to the world and to the church, that says, I think we can hold things together that are often segmented and compartmentalized in ways that are faithful to Jesus. So, but that's the flow of it.
That's helpful to hear. I did, even though it's got a topical kind of nature to it, I did get the sense as I was reading that there was a logical order and sequence to what you were doing. So you talk about contemplative rhythms for an exhausted life is chapter one. I think that you're diagnosing something there that you're seeing. So I'm curious if you could just speak to that for a minute or two. The exhausted life, contemplative rhythms, do you see that as being foundational for a life that's deeply formed? Is that the way that you were approaching things?
Yeah, you know, it's... part of it is just the rhythm and pace that we live that I think informs the ways that we address some of the more complex issues of race or politics or sexuality or justice. And so for contemplative rhythms, it's not just simply about slowing down our pace, but it's also giving ourselves, opening ourselves to God in contemplation, in reflection, in examination, so that we are addressing issues from a deeper kind of wisdom, not just a superficial wisdom of this is how we should see race or this is how we should see sexuality or justice or whatever it is. The quote that comes to mind, I don't know if I put it in the book or not, but it is this Robert Mulholland, who's a professor at Asbury Seminary. And he writes a phrase that there are two ways of being in the world. The first way of being in the world for God or being in God for the world. That's a really big distinction. And for me, the contemplative rhythms piece is about being in God for the sake of the world, not being in the world for God.
Yeah.
And because you can be in the world for God without God, and which is the temptation for all of us. Sure. The contemplative life is about a life of being, a life of beholding, of contemplation, of reflection. And I think everything needs to flow from that place.
Rich, I'm probably making more meaning out of this than I should, but we're preachers. That's what we do, right? We got to find something. So right at the center of your five practices, we've got interior examination. And I like to think of this as sort of cross-examining your own certainty. You know, we, in a world that puts everyone else on the stand, get up on the stand yourself. Mm-hmm. So talk to me about interior examination in a world that loves to point the finger.
Yeah, other examination comes very easily to us and comes and to me. The kind of interior examination really is a bridge, I think, to... in terms of the breakdown of the chapters in how we think about race on one side, sexuality and justice on the other, if it's not flowing from a place of vulnerability, honesty, humility, a wrestling with our own shortcomings and sins, our own anxieties and triggers, I don't know if we are in the right position to address some of these very complex issues, which is why, as a preacher, to talk about preaching, if whenever I train preachers, one of the important questions I'm having them wrestle with is, and it's such a simple foundational question, but you'd be amazed at how easy it is not to ask the question. And the question is, how is this text passing through your life first?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how that question is not asked.
Yep.
And so I could talk about don't be afraid. Mm-hmm. And in the week of sermon prep, not take 5 minutes to investigate the ways that I am carrying fear, which number one leaves out important content that can really connect with people. But number two, creates, I think, a unnecessary dichotomizing of individual life and proclamation. Mm-hmm. So I think the interior examination part is, you know, to that degree that we're able to look inward, mm-hmm. not in some form of navel gazing, unhealthy self-confrontation, in a compassionate confrontational way, that's going to really serve as the foundation that we need to wrestle with some of these really complicated and potentially divisive issues.
What I've always loved about your work, and I was so thrilled about this book and had the, you know, privilege of reading it early and having lots of conversations with you about it, Rich, but what I think you're doing that's so brilliant and I think fairly unique is that you put together the world of sort of inward examination and contemplation and the outward work of the necessary outward work of activism and justice and all of that. And it seems like we are always tempted to choose one or the other, that we're either sort of out there trying to change the world, or we're in retreating into our interior castle, as it were, to kind of commune with God. And the two belong together. Can you speak to the temptation that pastors maybe are feeling? Because we so much of our work is exterior, and something happens and we need to offer comments or guidance. But the temptation to be a commentator, a professional commentator, but then also the tendency to say, no, man, I'm just going to keep worshiping and have our little prayer meetings and not letting prayer push us outward. Could you speak to that for a moment?
Yeah, I think of two ways to address that. One being the call really is to resist formational compartmentalization. Mm. And by that, I mean, at least from the traditions that have shaped me, I've been shaped by three primary traditions: the Pentecostal tradition, the evangelical tradition, and the progressive tradition. Mm. And in each of these traditions, there's a particular way of ordering one's life. And so for the evangelical tradition, broadly speaking, it's often about right thinking. Mm. For the Pentecostal charismatic tradition, it's often about right experiences. Mm. And for the progressive tradition, it's about right action, right justice.
Sure.
And for me, what I've noticed is it's often the case that people have right theology, or they're wrestling faithfully with theology, but they're not opening themselves up to necessary experiences that the Spirit can give. Or it's the case that people are really giving themselves to activism and engaging matters of justice, but is not coming from a theologically rooted place grounded in the gospel. And so what I'm trying to do is resist formational compartmentalization by holding together, yes, right wrestling with theology, the right kind of experiences. I believe the Spirit of God can change someone in a moment that would take many years of different kinds of work. And I believe in all kinds of therapy. And I mean, we talk about it all the time at New Life. Right. But I believe a moment, the Spirit of God can transform someone in a moment. I've seen it happen in many different occasions. Mm. So I want to open myself up to that. And at the same time, I want to hold together working for justice and the poor and the under-resourced and the overlooked. And so that's one way that I look at it, through formational compartmentalization. On the other side, what I talk about in towards the missional presence chapters is there is this temptation to be without doing, or to do without being.
Yeah.
And I don't see this as linear. I don't see this as neat. I don't see this as, okay, be first and then do. But I see them in it. I look at them dialectically. They yes. are, we're holding this paradox together. We're holding this, these two polar opposite things in dynamic tension with one another. And so people ask me, should I pray, you know, first and then do something, or should I do something and pray? For me, it's, we are constantly wrestling with the interplay of being with God mm-hmm. and doing for God. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's neat. I don't think it's, there, you know, it's simple orders to these things.
Yeah.
But exactly right. But for me, it's dialectical yeah. of which, and me being someone who, in terms theologically, who has learned so much from Karl Barth and my reading of Barth, who holds together dialectics. I mean, mm-hmm. for me, this is one of the dialectical things to hold together in not necessarily neat ways, but Glenn, that's how I speak to that formational compartmentalization there.
Which, just to name something else that you've addressed, and then we can get to some other questions here, but you, even naming the being and doing thing, I was going to comment on the brilliance of the structure of this, to where there's concept and then practices, concept and then practices. And I think for a long time in the evangelical world, we sort of think, if we could just, you know, we take the Romans 12 thing, the renewing mm-hmm. of your mind, be transformed, yeah. and we take that as the only thing the Bible has to say about transformation. And so it's concept, 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 mm-hmm. instead of how about practices, 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 practices. And in some ways, the practices could actually lead our thinking, and lead our bodies can lead our brains.
Yep. Yes. Yeah, I think so. And I mean, when I think about our engagement in the world and practices, you know, Gustavo Gutierrez, he would talk about in his own theology, what theology is. Theology is reflection upon mm-hmm. praxis. Mm-hmm. And so for him, now he's coming from a Peruvian context, serving the poor. And so there's a great urgency for engagement and social engagement and justice. But his point was, what are we engaging ourselves in? What's the urgency? And theology is now reflection upon that praxis, mm-hmm. which is in the evangelical tradition, often the opposite takes
yep.
place.
Yep.
And if we even get to some of the practice, mm-hmm. praxis, mm-hmm. you know, but so I think that's another way to envision what we're trying to do here.
And you look at Jesus walking the roads, mm-hmm. calling disciples. He didn't invite yeah. them to the classroom. Mm-hmm. He said, follow me. And he's walking the dusty roads of Palestine. And his ministry was praxis. And then let's talk about it over dinner.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so I think that's a great image for us mm-hmm. to carry. Rich, I want to ask you, you talk about the traditions that have shaped you, but I want to ask you about some of the saints that have shaped you. Mm-hmm. And so question number one is kind of 1A and 1B. Who formed you, and who are the icons of a deeply formed life for you? So who laid hands on you and made you Rich Velotis? And who do you carry in your psyche and in your soul about that's what an icon of a deeply formed life looks like?
Yeah, I mean, for me, those saints, it starts with my grandfather, number one. I cannot think about following Christ and what I'm up to today without the 8 intensive months I had with him before he died. When I became a Christian and the point that he died, it was 8 months. Jeez. And he died April 16th. I became a Christian in the month of August of 1999. And so he was on his deathbed, had a bad heart condition, was withering every single day. And I would meet with him 4 to 5 days a week, 2 to 3 hours each time. Part of the reason why it was 2 to 3 hours was because of a language barrier. He spoke very little English. I spoke very little Spanish. And so half the time I'm like, what was that again, Grandpa?
¿Cómo se dice?
So it wasn't like we were all deep. Half the time was like, I just don't know what he said, or he doesn't know what I said. So sitting with him, I mean, he taught me a love of the scriptures. He taught me a love of the Trinity, of prayer, of holiness. And the enduring image I have of him as it pertains to scripture is I learned very early on that scripture was for the purpose of healing. I learned that very early on. And I learned that because the last 2 to 3 weeks of his life, he was just bedridden. He was laying down. He could hardly get up. And I would visit him, and the only thing he wanted me to do was read
the scriptures,
Bible verses to him.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And so he'd say, can you read me something from Romans? And I'd say, what? He goes, anything from Romans. And so I'd read something, and he'd just smile and go, yeah, yeah. And I'd go, can you read me something from Ephesians? And so this is me as a Christian for just for a few months. And I'm just reading him Bible stories after Bible story text and seeing him smile and then give him a kiss on the forehead and say, Grandpa, I'll see you tomorrow. We'll do it again.
Wow.
And so those images and memories and stories, he's the one who shaped me the most. I also often think about my Aunt Lydia, who actually lived in the same home. Lydia's the second oldest of 12 of their children. And Lydia, to this day, she lives in Florida. She is a saint, a holy woman of God. But she was the one who, besides giving me $100 every 2 weeks or so when I was a college student, and she just knew the Spirit always just said, yeah, $100 here.
Bless her, Lord.
Bless him. So besides that, which I needed as a college student,
exactly.
She had such a prophetic gift in terms of an insight into people's souls, just something about her that she knew when someone needed to be called. And so I would stay weekends with her when I was a college student. I lived in Nyack, New York, an hour drive down to Brooklyn. And I would live at her home every weekend and see her pick up the phone and say, God put you in my heart, and overhear conversations and hear her pray for people. So when I think about who's in the back of my mind, it's my grandfather, Marcus. It's my Aunt Lydia. It's my Aunt Minerva, who lived downstairs from me in our home. And so those are the people who no one knows. In terms of the people who people know, I have four portraits that my father-in-law painted in watercolor in my office of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Martin Luther King, Gardner Taylor, and Eugene Peterson. And
that'll do.
I'm still adding to my collection
right.
But those are four people. Gardner Taylor, known as kind of the dean of preaching
of
the church in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Dr. King, of course. Eugene, who of course you guys know very intimately knew very intimately, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So those are the guys who are in me deeper than I know.
Rich, I want to ask you a question about race and racial reconciliation. Following from your chapter, sort of that first part of your book on the exhausted life, contemplative rhythms, you move into this fractured world that we have, racially divided world, which we have seen in the headlines in the past year, more than we have in a very long time. It's just been an explosive year. And our listeners might not know, I think it's still the case that you serve a church in the most diverse zip code in the United States. Is that true still?
I don't know if it's true. At one point we were. I mean, it's pretty close.
It's got to be up there.
75 nations, you said?
That's it.
75 nations?
123 languages spoken in the neighborhood and 75 nations in our church.
Yeah. So I think we've established, it's been well established on this podcast, we think racial reconciliation is at the heart of the gospel. And so I know that's near and dear to your heart. It's a pragmatic concern for you. How do you keep all of these people together? So this is, it's so central to your ministry. The question that I want to ask you is, over the past year, pastoring in such a diverse congregation, what are some of the things that you find yourself saying more than you have said at other times, or some of the practices that you're counseling people into that you are now counseling them into more than you have at other times? So what in your ministry has dialed up because of some of what we've seen in our country in the past year?
Great question. Two things come to mind immediately. The things that I found myself saying repeatedly is, and in different contexts, whether I'm training 15 of our leaders in our school of formation, whether I'm leading classes or preaching, trying to help reimagine what the gospel is one thing. And I think that is the foundation of engaging matters of race. And so if I believe that the gospel is simply a soteriological transaction, or if it's just some status, post-mortem status, if I just limit the gospel to that or to an atonement theory, I'm going to miss the implications of what the gospel truly is. But if I believe that the gospel is the good news that the kingdom of God has come near in Jesus Christ, and that through his life, death, resurrection, and enthronement, the powers of sin and death no longer have the last word, then we can talk about the ways that we are to live into that reality that Jesus is Lord. And so I have found myself regularly coming back to what is the gospel? Mm-hmm. What do we mean when we say the gospel? And it's interesting because I just led 15, last week we had our fourth month of training for 15 of our leaders. And I gave them that definition that I just said to you. This is my humble, explication of the gospel here. And I was surprised how difficult it was for some people to receive that. Not that they didn't agree with it, but they were so trained to see the gospel in such a heaven, hell,
transactional
decision, transactional. Totally. And so,
if I can interrupt, even though they've been sitting under your preaching for a long time, which goes to show that people are not getting it until you are about sick of saying it as a pastor.
That's exactly right. And every time over and over. They wrote their responses, like, you know, 3-page responses to the class that we had. And they kept going back to how their early years of formation, and it's those early years of formation run deeper than you know. Those are deep. So the residue of our formation from early years, whether good or bad, runs very deep in us. So I have found myself having to say that on a regular basis, what the gospel is. Also reframing what racism is. Having to do that on a regular basis, that racism is not just just an individualist thing, that we have to look at it from at least 3 perspectives, from an individual, interpersonal, and institutional perspective. So having to continually redefine terms there. The practice that Andrew, it's a great question. I have found myself on a regular basis asking a fundamental question to help people navigate through this. And it is, how did your family of origin shape you with regard to matters of race? And to ask people to name the conscious and unconscious messages that they've received about Black people, Hispanic people, East Asian people, South Asian people, Middle Eastern people, white people, Native American people, the list goes on. To have them actually reflect and name it is a very painful, difficult exercise for a lot of people. But for me, I've had to come back to that because as someone who's a student of family systems theory, I recognize the ways that our families disproportionately shape us and form us, especially in those formative years of 8 to 12, 8 to 13 years old. And so if we can't go back to the scene of the crime, and identify where did the malformation take place, we're going to miss out on important content and fodder for reflection and rejection of the particular narratives and scripts and messages that we've received. So coming back to that has been something I have found myself doing on a regular basis.
So let's extend this and make this a little bit of a lab moment. You know, we talked about how you're marrying together the interior and the exterior and all of that, and concept and practices. And so that's a practice that's an interior practice where you're reflecting on how I was formed. But then you go on in the next chapter and you talk about one of the habits of incarnational listening. Describe that for people just as a laboratory of like how these two things kind of touch one another. It's not enough to just reflect on the roots, but how do we practice a different way?
The incarnational listening part for me, again, flows out of the story of Jesus, number one, and the life of the gospel, where we see Jesus leaving heaven, into earth. John 1:14, the word becomes flesh and dwells among us. And so he leaves, he enters, and he allows himself to be shaped by the new world that he finds himself in while holding on to himself, So it is this in the best sense of the word, it is good differentiation, where he's able to hold on to himself and enter into a new space. But when I think about listening, which what I talk about it, I talk about it, number one, from the lens of like a Philippians 2.
Yeah.
So this is a self-emptying. So we're called to listen in the bond of peace. There's a sense of mutuality of listening in the body of Christ. However, I do believe it is a very Christ-like thing to do, to recognize power and privilege and position. And it's a very Christ-like thing to do, to lay that aside, to take the lead in listening to someone else's story. Mm-hmm. And so whether we're talking about men and women in a patriarchal society, and men being willing to say, I'm going to listen to the perspective of a woman. Let me give a very clear anecdote to this. Just a couple of days ago, the Mets, it always comes back to teams. The Mets fired their general manager.
Yeah.
And Sandy Alderson, the president of baseball operations, was asked, when you did all your references for this GM, here was the question. Did you get any references from women? And he said, no. He said, no. And for me, it was a striking moment. It was a revelatory moment where it's a big organization, the New York Mets, and all the references were just guys. There was no listening to women. And I just thought, imagine if they listened to a woman. Now, I don't know if, you know, sure. But what if she said, yeah, we had a few awkward interactions with this guy here. But so I think from a male female perspective, from a wealthy, economically challenging perspective, you know, who listens first and who listens more often?
Mm-hmm.
From a a white black perspective or whatever it might be. So I do think we are called to listen in the bond of peace. But those who have enjoyed the privileges of social power must take the lead as Christians. This is a very Christ-like thing to do. But what it entails, this is the hard thing, because I could teach a skill about, okay, leave your world, enter to someone, be curious, be present, hold on to yourself. But to listen requires such a level of self-awareness,
empathy,
recognizing your own triggers, your own tendencies to want to fix others and be right and have the last word, kind of, you know, the whole Dallas Willard thing of, you know, I'm practicing the discipline of not having the last word.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so much there, but at its core, Glenn, it's how do we leave our world and enter to someone else's story, hear their perspective, and allow ourselves to be shaped by that, while at the same time not letting go of ourselves. And when we need to, through the way of the gospel, begin to live in a different way, seeing things from their perspective, especially in ways that are in concert with the message of the gospel. So sorry for that long answer, but I mean, that's some of the ways that I'm trying to think through that.
The book is The Deeply Formed Life. We're grateful that you were able to talk with us today, Rich. I want to give you 1 minute here just to talk about, as we wrap up, as you survey the landscape of the church in our time right now, there is so much to be discouraged by. I'm wondering what you're seeing out there that's got you encouraged. I'm wondering what you're seeing out there that is a sign of hope for you, that people are embracing the message of the kingdom and living into it.
I'm very hopeful. I mean, in our congregation and many congregations in New York City, I'm in conversation with a lot of pastors in the New York City area, and I know of other churches in our country. Number one, I'm very encouraged by the level of leadership, creativity, and innovation we're seeing from leaders and pastors and churches, a willingness to try something new, a malleability, a kind of dexterity. I mean, so I see it and I go, people are really adjusting to this new reality, this hybridity that we're experiencing, that we're seeing, and doing it with joy and life. And I mean, who wants to be, I mean, we're still preaching in front of cameras over here. Who wants to be doing that?
Mm-hmm.
Yet I'm seeing people faithfully continue to do that. I'm also very encouraged by so many people who are investigating the claims of Christ and the church in this space here. And so while there's tons of news about, you know, people moving away from the church, I see lots of great stories of people saying this pandemic, this political hostility, this racial injustice is pulling me to something deeper and higher that I desperately need. And so I'm encouraged. I mean, you know, turn off the news for a second and just, you know, call another pastor or talk, you know, talk some, there's got lots of great life taking place in our churches. Yeah. And so I'm encouraged and, by the leadership, innovation, creativity, and I'm encouraged by the openness that I'm seeing from a lot of people who have never entered into our churches, but are longing for something deeper to a deeper story to belong to, a deeper experience that goes beyond the experiences that they've tried to create for themselves. So I'm very encouraged by some of those things.